ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Soleri Report for the week of the July. We started with July 4th on Sunday, July 5th on Monday, which was a holiday in the United States. And it's John Titus and Catherine Fitz back in a state of complete amusement. You just couldn't believe what's going on. But at least I can say after you talk with John and me, you'll know what's going on. John, welcome back. I see you're still in the CIA safe house.
I am. I'm safe, and I'm cool this week.
You got a fan downstairs?
I got a fan downstairs. I got the AC blasting, and I have an ice pack on my back. That's good.
So our theme that we chose after running through sort of what was going on over this last week was the pandemic heroes in the long hot summer.
Pushback heroes
in the long hot summer. Yeah. And that, to me, that is the most important thing that's happened in the last week. You have seen incredible courage and bravery like I've never seen before. It's unbelievable. It's like a blossoming of freedom. And the thing that really struck me, because I remember when it happened to me, is you have these brilliant doctors, scientists, and lawyers all saying, you know something? I don't want your jobs. I don't want your positions. I don't want your awards. I don't care about, you know, I don't care if I never hear from Harvard again, even though I went there. You know, I want nothing to do with you guys because you're all perverts. I just, you know, I'm ready to go start a whole new civilization.
Right. You guys are criminals. I don't want a piece of you.
Right.
You know, if that means I can lose my medical license, then I will.
Right. Yeah. Right. They care more about science and more about their medical vows than they care about the regulators. Right.
Right. We're starting to see the meaning of oaths. You take an oath.
Right.
That's that.
So these are people who absolutely live their oaths. Anyway, so there's been a lot of them, and it's been very inspiring. So pushback heroes, just everybody remember that.
It's not just physicians, though.
There's pushback
from all quarters.
Right.
But there have been some physicians that have put their professional licenses on the line. They know what they're doing.
Right. You know, this week we published, Corey Lynn of Corey Diggs did a story for us on how to go pushback at your school board in 3 to 5 minutes. You know, parents get like 3 to 5 minutes to say something.
Right.
So that will be up at Soleri.com and it's public, send it around. But, you know, if you haven't started pushing back in your local school board, you're going to need to before September. So hopefully that'll help. So let's dive in, John. We got a lot to cover.
We do have a lot to cover. And the first story, you know, it's not a pushback hero. This is the first story is about a Nuremberg candidate. And so let's just get into it.
Yeah.
This is the Ohio judge. And so the judge, let me get this off. It's not bothering me. Mandates COVID-19 shots for offenders as terms of probation. And I've just highlighted one of the cases here. One of the defendants was sentenced to probation for a gun and drug charge. And the defendant said, Judge Fry told him in court, they could reduce the length of his probation from 5 years to 1 year if he agreed to the jab. If he went ahead and got the COVID vaccination, he'd have his sentence.
So if he's still alive after a year, he can go free.
Right. Right. And so that's just a terrible story, I think.
Anyway. But it names names, and that's somebody.
Right.
You know, I believe one of the most powerful political tactics is shunning.
Yeah.
And that's a judge who deserves a shunning.
That certainly is. It really is. You deserve a major shunning for that. Anyway, so that's you know, kind of leading off on a bad note, but let's just move on. This next story is very interesting. This is out of Luxembourg, and there's been a little bit of follow-up on this. Prime Minister Xavier Bettel seriously ill with COVID-19. Now, query whether that's really COVID-19 or whether COVID-19 is simply the cover story, given the timing. This guy looks pretty healthy to me. You know, he's
a very healthy guy.
Yeah, he's robust. He's openly gay leader in Luxembourg. He's 48 years old, was hospitalized Sunday for what they described as tests and medical observation. That's why he's in the hospital. But he's since been diagnosed. So he goes to the hospital with these with these symptoms. And of course, they diagnose it as COVID-19. They say he has insufficient oxygen saturation, but then the story says specific details were not released. And he tested positive for COVID-19 on June 27th after he returned from the EU summit in Belgium. He suffered from fever and headache at the time and continued his work from home, which included a digital meeting, interestingly enough, with Google CEO Sundar Pichai on Thursday. He received his first dose of AstraZeneca's vaccine on May 6th and was still waiting for his second shot when he tested positive. So that's an interesting story.
So you sort of wonder what he said to Google or at the EU summit that irritated someone.
Yeah. Also, May 6th to late June. I mean, I guess it's, you know, I don't know, since I'm not getting the shot. It was 8 weeks or 6 weeks separation. Normal, I guess. Maybe
I don't
it is.
Know. I don't
anyway,
know.
The guy, very healthy at one point and gets sick, you know, miraculously gets COVID at a summit where you know everybody's wearing masks, right?
They never wear masks.
Well, that's right. They're wearing masks for the cameras. Right. They're not wearing masks when they're not on camera. That's for sure. That's a very good point. Right. Anyway, he's got COVID. Anyway, that's an interesting story.
This happened. I found out about this. Justin just let me know when I dialed in for this recording. Apparently, the Haitian president has been assassinated. They broke into his house.
No.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't hear that.
I have to check, but
wow,
it's a dangerous time to lead a country.
It is, and we're gonna get to a story about that in a bit that sort of highlights that. Not that dangerous, not assassination dangerous, but economically probably even more dangerous.
Right.
You're right. It is a dangerous time. But to continue on, next story. This is a good one. Let me scroll this down a little bit so you can see it there. Get that down a little bit more. Okay. Majority of physicians declined COVID shots, according to a survey by the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. And so in the first sentence I highlighted here, 700 physicians responding to an internet survey put out by this group, AAPS, nearly 60% say they were not fully vaccinated against COVID. And that's an interesting number because the AMA, the American Medical Association, you see there in the second paragraph, had come out and said, hey, 96% of practicing physicians are fully vaccinated. And they base that on 300 respondents. So there's a little bit of discrepancy there. In fact, there's a major discrepancy there. So the AMA is coming out with propaganda saying 96% are vaccinated, according to a survey of our buddies. We have 300 of them. And the AAPS comes out with 700 survey. It says, no, only 54% of physicians respondents, that they say 60% are not fully vaccinated. And then the survey also said separately that 54% of physician respondents in this survey, the AAPS survey, were aware of patients suffering from a significant adverse reaction. So more than half are saying, yeah, my patients are undergoing serious adverse reactions.
Wow.
And so 80% of the unvaccinated physicians in the survey, 80% said, I believe the risk of shots exceed the risk of the disease. And 30% said, I already had COVID.
Right.
So they're pushing back here big time. You know?
Well, now that it's come out, everybody has herd immunity, plus all the early intervention treatments are effective.
Right. 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 They do work. And we'll see, you know, in fact, we should go to a couple clips now.
You know, I just have to say when I was in Washington, you know, our assumption as political appointees is that what the American Medical Association was sort of like taking testimony from Dennis the Menace.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
It's just, there were some associations that were very reliable and, you know, you could rely on, but that was not one of them.
Right. Yeah, you got that right. I want to change something up real quick here. Can you still hear me? No.
I can't hear you.
Okay, yeah. You can hear me now. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to roll a video And I want the audio to go through. I just realized why you're not able to hear video, and just so next time you'll be able to hear the video.
So but, I just want to tell you, I appreciate you doing these videos because I thought they were choice. So I really wanted you to play them.
Yeah. And so this week we've got five videos this week, but they're all worthy, you know? So it's not like we're just putting kind of crappy videos in there. These are good videos. So let's go to the first video. And this is a Canadian health official, and he's talking about vaccinating kids. And just the casualness of this guy is what gets me. So I'm going to roll right into it. It's going to start right away as soon as I click over. Okay, here we go.
Well, they need their parents' permission to get vaccines. And in terms of, I guess, just capacity of vaccination sites, will those youth be able to have their parents, a guardian, accompany them in to get their vaccines? How will that look once children start being vaccinated?
So we don't actually require for even our routine grade 7 vaccinations. They don't actually have to have parental consent. It's on the judgment of the immunizer whether the child, the youth is determined to be able to make their own decision around vaccine. And that will carry through for COVID vaccination as well.
Yeah. Okay. So you heard it there. The health officials very casually says, the parental consent not required. A youth is able to make their own determinations on getting vaccinated.
Right. And this is very important because we think the FDA is likely to give full authorization to one or more of the vaccinations before September in the United States.
Right.
And elsewhere. So if you get full authorization as opposed to emergency authorization, even though there's no basis in fact to get a full authorization, but if they do, it's going to make it much easier for the public officials, health officials, to try and mandate in the schools, get the employers to mandate, but also to lower the consent age.
Right.
None of which I think is constitutional or legal, but that's not going to stop them.
I know. Legality has gone out the window. And this has been, I've been on this since 2013, 14.
Right.
Just, you can't just throw the law out the window and expect no repercussions. You end up with a system run by criminals. And now you're seeing it. And that leads me to the next video. This video I found stunning. It's a cartoon from 1930.
Right.
And it's an American cartoon, but this version of it is of a version that was, say, playing in Italy. And so you see Italian subtitles on it. Just ignore the Italian subtitles. And a lot of it, remember, it's coming on the heels of the silent film era. So there's a lot of cueing via titles and subtitles and whatnot. And they're very important, but I want to play this because this cartoon in the space of 2 minutes lays out the entire scenario. Correct. I mean,
here we go again. I've been to this movie before. Here we go.
My jaw dropped, especially the very end. But pay attention to the subtitles end. This is just stunning.
Remember your mother, we never leave your side.
Okay, so there you have it.
Yeah. So I just want to say big thanks. There were two subscribers who sent that in, or one posted it.
Okay.
And I think that's how we found it.
Okay. Yeah. But it's just a jaw-dropping cartoon from 1930. But just,
well, if you look at that reference to the plague laws in the Michael Pye's book, The Edge of the World, this has been going on for hundreds of years. It's an old playbook.
It's amazing. But right. But just I took some notes while we just watched that, just to touch on the ones from 1930 that are in place now. A parade around your sick and your dead. You saw right. that. Remember to put your mask on. That was the voiceover, just refrained over and over. Euthanize the old. That was a big one, of course, in New York.
So I want to just, I know we covered this, but people may not realize that the UK health minister just had to resign because it was documented and proved by Jackie DeVoe and her whistleblowers that they were euthanizing enormous amounts of elderly in the UK and calling it COVID, but it wasn't, it was euthanasia.
Right. The COVID's just a cover story for the right. euthanasia.
Right.
And then the final point with to me, the most stunning one of all was one at the end of the cartoon, people who own the banks now own the hospitals, which right. is true. That's very true of private equity.
Right.
You know, that's who owns these hospitals.
Right.
Anyway, so that's video number two. We have a few more as we move on, but for now I want to go over to the next story, which is, this is from the military.
Yeah. And this is a clear indication that the FDA is going to give full authorization before September.
Yeah, and so this comes from, to scroll up here in this, the directive came from an executive order sent to the armed forces, by the Department of the Army headquarters. And commanders will continue COVID-19 vaccination operations and prepare for a directive to mandate, you know, the vaccination for service members at on around 1st of September 2021, pending a full FDA licensure. So you're exactly right.
Right.
That's where that's coming from.
Well, I think I sent it to you. The press secretary for Biden announced five initiatives to improve the vaccination uptake, including going door to door.
Door to door.
So right. Start putting up gates on your driveway and stop answering the doorbell.
Yeah.
If don't answer the door unless somebody's made an appointment to see you.
Yeah. I mean, I asked people, I said, you know, how much is it going to take before you realize this is just fascism and we're across the line and we're into full Nazism? You know, right. We have the yellow star, right? You have to, with your vaccination card. Now you got your door-to-door visits. Is that enough? Or do they need to remove people from houses and put them into trains? Will you get on board then? Right. When are you going to wake up? And no. You know, the denial is just stunning. Anyway, let's go to another Canadian health video. And this one is a Canadian health official, and this comes from, we extracted these from an Amazing Polly. She had a show or a YouTube episode, and she ran a couple of videos. I extracted both of them because they're both really good. The first one.
This is a demonstration that the sovereign governments have no sovereignty.
Yeah. Right. This is an implied demonstration. Right. Somebody asked the health official, hey, what about ivermectin? And so we get this. We get the following. Here's the video.
So if we're fighting this disease from, you know, from the sky, from the land, and from the sea, so to speak, there also seems to be another kind of hesitancy. And I'm speaking about treatment drugs. There's a hesitancy to talk about ivermectin. There's a hesitancy to try it, it seems. Maybe you know something more about what our health system is doing, but there's certainly news that ivermectin, I mean, Dr. Alessandro Santon, an oncologist working with a laboratory at Yale, believes that ivermectin could be very effective. He's worked with it, he's tried it, and of course, he's not the only one. It's apparently a drug that does no harm. In particular, it's not got a big risk to try it, but it has helped many, many people. Are we doing anything with that? And if not, why not?
We're pursuing domestic research that we hope can lead to better vaccine availability in the future, perhaps not during this wave, but when we need boosters in coming years, or if there's another pandemic, to have Canadian research available. And we have production, of course, in Manitoba. It's our leading industry is drug manufacturing. I just want to say thanks to all concerned for the rain. Our fire situation, though not fully addressed, is been significantly reduced in terms of its danger as a consequence of this rain. And of course, when farmers make money, we're all better off. And this is $1 billion rain for our ag community. So I want to thank the people in charge for making that rain available. Keep up the great work. Thanks, everybody. Have a safe long weekend.
Okay. So, yeah, what about ivermectin? And the answer is, well, we're doing great research in vaccine. And thanks, everybody, for the great rain you gave us. We really needed it.
So 2 points.
Unbelievable.
When I was trained, I used to be a surrogate speaker in New York for the Republican Party during several campaigns. Uh-huh. And we were trained by Roger Ailes and Ray Price. Ray had been a speechwriter for Nixon during the Nixon administration. He was an amazing guy. He ran the Economics Club. It's the Economics Club. Anyway, but we were taught if you get a question you don't want to answer, just non sequitur, answer the question you wish you'd gotten. First you say, thank you, that's a great question. And then you do a non sequitur and answer the question you wish you'd gotten. And then the second thing I want to say is my interpretation of what he said was, you know, we are following the orders of people who have weather manipulation tactics. And if we don't play ball, we're not going to get any rain. That's my interpretation.
I missed that the first time I saw that clip, and then you said it, and now I just watch it. And it's almost in your face, him saying, right, thanks to the people responsible for the rain.
Right. There you go. I think.
Wow.
I think invisible space weaponry is driving this train. If you watch my testimony in front of the German Corona Investigation Committee, fabulous group of people, I tried to tell them about the Indonesian tsunami, and then I thought, you know, the satellite and weather warfare and the invisible technology was a critical piece of this. And they were kind of looking at me like, huh?
Yeah.
It was interesting, but I think that's driving this train. I really do. Right.
Oh, amazing. Anyway, let's do the last. So this isn't the last video, but it's the last video in our Farmageddon segment. And this is another Canadian official. And he's asked, like, hey, you know,
I love an honest government official. Here we go.
Yeah, here we go. Just what are you doing with these health officials? Well, yeah, anyway, here we go.
You keep saying that you've got to get the green light from doctors, but where does the leadership of a politician come in, whether it's dealing with Dr. Williams or telling someone like Dr. Davila, who quite frankly I think would keep us locked down for months to come? Mm-hmm. At what point do you, as the person in charge, the elected official, say, you know what, I understand your position, I've heard your concerns, but there's other evidence and there are needs out there that go beyond just dealing with COVID.
Sure. Could I go out there and be the only politician in the entire country, including the prime minister, all premiers, every single mayor, because I've talked to the vast majority of them, and say, okay, docs, I'm not a medical professional, but I'm going to disagree with you. When I said I'm going to follow their direction on health advice, right from day one. And then if I did that, they could slap a Section 22 down and it's just friction. You know, I'm going to stick with what I've done right from the beginning. I'm going to stick with health and science and work with them collaboratively. But I'm going to be very frank. There's no politician in this country is going to disagree with their chief medical officer. They just aren't going to do it. They might as well throw a rope around their neck and jump off a bridge. They're done. I'm telling you the facts. It's very simple.
So, yeah, it's easy. Every politician in Canada is a coward, and that's that. So that's what we just heard. So he just comes out and says every politician in Canada is a total coward, and that's just that. So we're going to do whatever health officials say.
So I think we should invite him to dinner with Carstens and us. We collect up the honest central bankers and honest government officials, and then we can have a dinner. You know, we can have an honest conversation.
Yeah, the conversation will be, you know, we're total cowards, but we have complete control. Isn't that great? Cowards in total control.
What could possibly go wrong?
What's wrong with this fix? Nothing. This is heaven. Anyway, so that was the last of the Farmageddon videos, last of Farmageddon. And so now it's time to move on to diluting the brand.
So let me just mention, before we leave Farmageddon, I want everybody listening to this to prepare to deal with employers and schools and school boards or anybody else you're interacting with in September, assuming full authorization. That's what we have to be prepared for. And we have 4 to 6 weeks, really, to get that done.
You saw the date in the Pentagon story with the vaccination of the Army.
What was their date?
September 1st.
September 1st. So,
yeah.
But some schools start earlier.
Right.
So I just think, you know, I just think you got to have your plan in place and be ready to act four to eight weeks from now. And a lot of people are going to have to start homeschooling or pulling their kids out of school. So.
And that's already going on. And even with the Army story, you're already seeing pushback on that. I've seen stories about people saying, I think a congressman came out and said, you know, a lot of people in the Army are going to quit.
Right. Well, we have more in pushback. So yeah. A lot of people pushing back. Okay. Diluting the brand, an even more depressing section. We're getting all the depression out early in this show.
Yeah. This is kind of going to be a blunderbuss of stories, this shotgun blast. But let's just get into it. This is from Breitbart. NPR celebrates Independence Day by portraying Declaration of Independence as racist. And for years, apparently, NPR has had a reading of the Declaration of Independence, and they reluctantly did it this year. You see there, reluctantly, they agreed to do it this year. But this year, they wanted to go through and very helpfully point out the flaws and racist elements in this founding document of our republic. And so that's what they did. And they went through, they fly-specked the Declaration of Independence and concluded that it was racist, and that was really that. You know, what a wonderful way to celebrate the holiday, you know?
Right. So, you know, so we're going to go through a series of different, I would say, outlets whose job is propaganda.
Yeah.
And their job is to help re-engineer the governance system. And that's what they're doing. And they all were on, you know, they were all playing the same little flute over July 4th.
Yeah. And we'll get to a series of stories on that. But, you know, the Declaration of Independence, that's where Americans... We went to our own monetary system. That's what really caused it and really said, you know, we're our own country and we have the rule of law here. And the whole Declaration of Independence is embodies the rule of law. Because it's like, you know, you're a criminal, King George III. Here are all these criminal acts you've done and we don't consent to it. And without our consent, you got to go.
Right.
You know,
but it all came down to taxation without representation.
That was a principal one.
Right.
Yeah.
That was the Boston Tea Party. So it's coming down to the same thing here.
Yeah, right. Like the 1930 cartoon, the history repeats. Okay, continuing on to this. This is a story. The next is the obituary of Rumsfeld. And I'll let you kind of pick up on this one.
So Scott Ritter was a UN weapons inspector and a U.S. intelligence officer who is an incredible, you know, talk about heroes of the 90s. You know, Scott Ritter was one of the great heroes. And constantly stopped a lot of shenanigans in the Middle East as a result of hard work and facts. And he took the moment of the death of Donald Rumsfeld, I guess it was late last week, early this week, but he took that occasion on July 4th to write a piece on Rumsfeld as a desk killer. It's a German expression, people who, you know, kill with a pen.
Right.
And Rumsfeld, you know, it's hard to, it would really, sometime I'd love to have a bottle of wine with a group of people and figure out if Cheney or Rumsfeld was more corrupt, because
yeah,
that would be quite a competition. But
an evil contest.
Rumsfeld was, you know, I don't know if he was mentally unstable or, you know, just a psychopath or what, but anyway, but Ritter just nails him to the wall. And this is one of the greatest pieces of pushback over the July 4th weekend. And I just want to celebrate and thank Scott Ritter. He did a great job.
Yeah. So the piece points out, you know, it's really, he saw it up close, firsthand experience Ritter had twice, you know, once with the nuclear arms race with Russia, where Rumsfeld was dishonest about that and dishonest on the side of provoking war, trying to. And then again in Iraq with the weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, they, you know, tried he was... to, he reports on one of the efforts to falsely you know, they didn't have any weapons of mass destruction to start a war with, so they tried to falsely frame it. It didn't work.
Yeah, it didn't work. Okay, so let's continue on with more dilution stories. And here's just a quick series of them. America-hating New York Times trashes U.S. flag on Independence Day. I think this is a story from Town Hall, but not really a lot to dwell on here. It's a deceiving piece entitled "Fourth of July, Symbol of Unity, May No Longer Unite." You know, that's the New York Times spin on it. And I agree with you, Catherine. This is an orchestrated effort.
It's an orchestrated effort across many different platforms.
Same time, same theme.
Right.
You know. National Geographic claims 4th of July fireworks are racist. Smoke targets communities of color. So, you know, fireworks.
Just good news. Christy Cameron, who we highlighted, she's got a great fireworks stand outside of Dallas, Texas. I just got a note from her yesterday. She had her best year ever.
Really?
Yeah. So believe National Geographic.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Or, you know, do believe it and just admit
America had a great time with their fireworks this year.
Yeah. So.
And then was there one more?
Yeah, there's one more. This is a big one. At first, I hesitated this, and then I realized that it needed to be included. This is a Breitbart story. About Marvel Comics making Captain America say the American dream is a lie. And in a lot of ways, there are a lot of lies with American mythology. But the problem with doing it as a comic, with a comic book character, a hero,
right,
is that that's like the official position. In other words, everybody knows, I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. Everybody knows that the rule of law really, that's sort of an ideal.
Right.
Right. And that, you know, of course the rich and powerful have better access to justice than the poor people.
Right.
Everybody, nobody would make an intelligent argument that it were otherwise. But the value that the rule of law has, the ideal, is that it enables you to hold officials' feet to the fire and say, oh, really? It really is the equality for all? Then why are black people at the back of the bus?
Right.
You know, and so on and so forth. So by having, you know, when you attack the ideal, which the Justice Department does repeatedly, saying all banks are above the law, basically, that's a much more pernicious thing. And that's what's going on
it's
here.
It's very dangerous.
With the Marvel Comics thing. It's like the ideal is wrong. It's like, well, no, the ideal is right.
Here's what they're trying to do. What they're trying to do, if you want to tear the country apart and globalize the dollar reserve system, the way you do that is you break America's heart. And you break their heart about their most cherished values, and you try and get them believing that they don't share those values, which is not true, because we do share those values.
Right.
And what I would say to everyone, because I heard many too many times this week during over the July 4th holiday, John, people saying to me, why is the New York Times doing this? Why is the Washington Post doing this? Why is National Geographic doing this? And I said, that's not the problem. They're doing their job. The problem is that you're listening to them. Now, we're highlighting what they said, too. But, you know, these organizations are not media. They're something else. You know, their job is to promote and defend a governance system.
Right.
And the way it's being reengineered. And you have to stop taking them seriously.
Yeah. And I must remind people, the Smith-Mundt Act, which forbade propagandization of a domestic American population, was repealed in 2014 by Obama, by the constitutional scholar.
Exactly.
That was not done for no reason.
No, that was done so they could do this.
Right. So you're seeing the fruits of this. It's not really the media anymore. These people are just corporate secretaries, they're corporate stenographers, they're propagandists, and it's in your face all the time.
Right.
And you just saw an example of it with those stories from all
but
different
we can
organs.
Turn it off.
Right. Do you turn it off, not believe the stories, and go buy Christie's fireworks, right?
Exactly.
Right.
There you go.
Yeah, that's the correct response.
Right. Absolutely.
Okay.
Okay.
On to FedWatch. The first story doesn't really require too much explanation here. So we have the global tax, right?
Right.
But lo and behold, look at this.
Financial
firms are going to be exempt from new global tax rules. So talk about the rule of law out the window. Here you go. It's, you know, there's rules don't apply to me. They only apply to you. Global tax for you, not for me.
Right.
Right? Wow.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Another story in FedWatch, and this gets into why it's dangerous to be, it's a dangerous time for a lot of people. Here you go. Can you see that? Lebanon currency drops to new low.
You know, when you have this level of disaster capitalism, remember one estimate was that when the Going Direct got approved and they moved forward, included the pandemic aspect, 500 million people put out of work. We talked, you know, when you did the Going Direct presentation, we talked about how many people, you know, that could have, what kind of unemployment that could cause, at least in the United States.
Right.
And, you know, the estimate was 500 million at the peak, backing down to 250 million. That kills a lot of people. But it what it does is when you shut down that much economy, particularly all the small business and small farmers, or make it difficult for them to operate, then anybody who's weak and on the edge is in real trouble. And from everything I can tell, and it's hard to get good news coming out of Lebanon, they are in a complete economic meltdown
yeah.
in a way that is exceptionally dangerous. And if we continue on the road we are, which I'm assuming we will as long as the Going Direct reset is in place, you know, this is going to happen to a lot more people. And it's one of the reasons that those people will desperately seek those IMF loans now made possible by the new SDRs. You know, it's all part of entrapping people in their debt. It's a debt entrapment, and it's a very, it's a spider's web. I don't know if you've seen the cover for the new, for CBDC, but it's, you know, it's a spider in a web.
Yeah.
And Lebanon is one of the first victims.
Right. And so that story touches on it. I want to just highlight a couple of things in this story so people can see. Market dealers said Lebanon pound was trading around 15,000, you know, it lost 90% of what it was worth in late 2019.
Right.
90%.
Right.
And so what's the upshot of that? Well, some hospitals are ruling out elective procedures, only doing emergency procedures. Pharmacies have a two-day strike as medications run out, and long queues for gasoline have frustrated motorists. And here's another one. This is super bad. Depositors locked out of their dollar accounts since last year have been promised some access starting July. You were able to get $400, perhaps. But here we go. IMF said Thursday it criticized Lebanon's proposal for dollar deposit withdrawals. You know, so there's the inevitable IMF is there to criticize, you know, to cause the problem and then then criticize the solution to the problem.
Right.
You know, so that's, you know, it's very dangerous. These criminals don't care about you. They don't care about, if they're doing this to Lebanon, to think that that's not going to happen to you because you're American is just dreaming. You're dreaming.
Well, it's been happening to Americans all along. It's happening to them all over the country.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Anyway, continuing on with the Fed story. This next story, there's going to be a pop-up of one of my least favorite people. And I couldn't get an archive version of the story. I apologize in advance for the pop-up, but let's take a look. It's about the dividends. Okay, here we go. Three financial giants announcing tremendous dividend increases. So The backstory here is 23 U.S. banks passed the stress test administered by the Federal Reserve. And this story from a publication, gurufocus.com, it zeroes in on Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Wells Fargo. Goldman is raising its dividend 60% to $2 a share.
That's a huge dividend increase.
That's unbelievable. That's a massive dividend. You know, dividend increases are more like, you know, 5%. But look at this. Here's Morgan Stanley. There's the pop-up. Damn it. It's Warren Buffett. Anyway.
100%. Right.
To 270 cents from 35 cents. So it extends its growth through 8 years. So that's its annualized dividend is now $2.80. And Wells Fargo is also doubling its dividend to 20 cents from 10 cents. So it's now an 80 cent. Per year dividend. But anyway, they passed the stress test. And
so it's amazing when the Fed prints and injects how many friends these guys can buy.
It is.
Yeah.
Right. Right. We injected $3.5 trillion times two, because $3.5 trillion ends up in commercial banks, and then another $3.5 trillion ends up in entities other than commercial banks. It's $7 trillion
right. floating around. You're just talking about what's on the books.
Yeah.
What's going on off books?
Right.
Right.
Right. Anyway, so we're done with Uncle Warren there. And then the final one in FedWatch is, let's take a look at this. This is out of Spain. And let me just scroll down a little bit. There you go. Spain's proposed national security is proposed law would allow seizure of citizens' property during a health, quote, crisis. And so this is a proposed piece of legislation that just, it's super dangerous. I just can't even believe this, where under the pretext of a health crisis, you seize people's property.
I did just an awful. Incredible amount of research into asset forfeiture and seizure during the 90s. Mm-hmm. And I was convinced they're going to try and seize my home, you know, because they're trying to shut down every source of income and asset. And I hired, as an attorney, the guy who had written the law for the Department of Justice when he was at the Department of Justice. He wrote the asset forfeiture laws in the 80s. So I hired him and sat him down with my attorney, you know, who was from a fine, old, prestigious firm, who insisted they couldn't seize it. And this guy basically read him chapter and verse on why they could and how they could. Anyway, I ended up doing an incredible amount of research about what was going on in asset forfeiture in the U.S. and the relationship that the feds and the states and the local groups had sort of, you know, they'd created this joint venture thing that would allow all sorts of local seizures. Now, there's been some reform of the laws, but the reason I wanted to bring this up is, no matter where you are, I want you to look down the road and make sure this can't happen to you. And it's a matter of working with your state and local legislatures and enforcement. This is why you really care who's your sheriff. You get a bad sheriff and the games that can go on seizure and forfeiture, particularly if they try and play a domestic terrorism game in the United States, are really bad. So you don't want to wait until this game starts, because it's coming, John. It's coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you want to get ahead of it with the, you know, with your local council, your state legislators, and your sheriff. Most counties have sheriffs. This game can't go on if you're smart locally. If you wait until it happens, it's too late. And, yeah. You know, one of my big question marks is, are the eviction and foreclosure moratoriums going to come off? And is this stuff going to start with a bang along with evictions and foreclosures?
Yeah, that's the big question.
Right.
Because the moratorium is set to end soon, at which point people who haven't been paying their rent are going to have to not only start paying their rent, but they're
going to have to pay all the back rent. Right.
Yep.
So they're out. Yeah. I mean, I got to tell you, in New York, it's a great way to get people out of rent controlled apartments.
Yeah.
This is how you're finally going to get them out. Right.
Yeah. That's funny. I have a friend in New York in a rent control apartment who's about ready to move, not because she's not paying the rent, but just that time. And it's just like, wow, you know, people are leaving, you know, but I think that's a big reason for it. Anyway, let's just go to the CBDC now and see what's going on over here. This first story, I don't really know what to make of this story, but this is from Fed guy Quarles, his vice chairman for supervision. And he says, digital dollar could pose considerable risk to the financial system. Now, I don't think this indicates that the Fed in any way is going to hesitate to implement CBDC.
Right.
I think this is more of a placeholder, because the Fed doesn't really know how it's going to implement CBDC yet. And this just sort of gives it room to make a move in one direction or another.
Well, but I also think there is real concern about what the role of the tech firms will be, because the finance guys don't trust them, and sort of what they want to do with stable coins, where stable coins are going to fit in. Because remember, you got all these different sectors of the digital economy competing for a much lower spread. You know, you got the credit card companies, you got the tech companies, you got fintech, you got all these guys squeezing into that margin, and ultimately, the Fed's going to have a lot of power and control over who gets what.
Right. But take a look at this quote in the story. It's very interesting. This is from Quarles. It seems unlikely that the dollar status as a global reserve currency or the dollar's role as a dominant currency in international financial transactions will be threatened by a foreign central bank digital currency. That is absolutely ridiculous. The central bank digital currency is that one of the points of the central bank digital currency is to jettison the dollar as a world reserve currency and to implement another one. So look at that phrase.
Oh,
look how
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think what they may be trying to do is globalize the dollar and convert it to an all digital system.
Well, okay.
But so what they want is an all digital system. They don't really care whether you call it dollar or wampum beads.
Here's another reason though to have. Remember that the Fed is the king of the hill in the U.S. in terms of monetary terms.
Right.
Because banks can be bankrupted. Okay. You want to bankrupt a bank? Send somebody in the bank. Say, you know what? I've got $10 million in account. I want it in cash.
Right.
Send a few customers in a bank like that. It's going to fold. And I don't care what bank it is. You can't do that to the Fed. Fed's king of the hill. You can't say, Fed, give me gold. Fed, give me commercial paper. Now, what happens with CBDC? The Fed can be bankrupted if there's a settlement currency that's global. So in other words, by having a CBDC that's global, you remove any ability of the Fed to be king of the hill. That's no longer the BIS or whoever will be king of the hill.
So it depends on how the CBDC system rolls out.
Yes.
Right now, I would say immediately the threat to the dollar as reserve currency is the euro.
It's not going to be the euro.
I don't think the euro will emerge as the digital or the global currency.
No, absolutely. Neither will Chinese currency.
But if you look at the market share right now, remember between World War I and World War II, sterling and the U.S. dollar shared. It was a duopoly. It wasn't one. But right now, if you look at the statistics, the euro is growing because people are getting more and more nervous about the dollar.
For sure. For sure.
Big play is they're trying to globalize whatever they do. They're trying to globalize the military. They're trying to globalize the dollar. And the question is, where is the Fed versus the European central banks and China and India going to fit in? It's not clear to me.
They'll fit in as colonies. That's where they're going to fit in. Answering to one global settlement currency that controls them all.
Right.
So let's go back and look at this quote by Quarles. It seems unlikely that the dollar status. So that's a crazy way to phrase that. It seems unlikely. That's the best you could do. I mean, he's not saying it'll never or whatever. It seems unlikely. I mean, that's just, it's not very reassuring, I don't think. Anyway, let's kick over to the next CBDC story. This is China. Speaking of another competitor, the China digital currency. Part of a triangle of risk challenging the international role of the euro. So China is just, you know, they keep plowing ahead with the digital currency.
Well, if you look at their plan to create liquidity for their currency.
Yeah.
It's a very good plan. And if you look at their execution, it's a good execution. Now, I don't think there's anybody in the world who would trust China to run a reserve currency.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't think, I mean, the key to this working is you're going to need the consent of a lot of powerful national players. At least at the beginning, you're going to need that.
Well, but this is why I keep coming back. Do you remember my expression, the Midianite thing?
Yeah.
Okay. So the reason I predict the Midianite thing is you need, for whatever the global financial system is, you need a governance structure that the majority of players trust. And there's nothing there that anybody can or should trust.
Right. 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 Yes.
Right. So.
Most certainly right.
Right. Yeah. Everybody's a poodle doing what they're told and nobody trusts anybody. What? How is that supposed to work?
I don't know. To me, the answer to that question is the only way that works is if there's some catastrophe. And it can't be some fake pandemic either. They need a bona fide emergency, you know, not some flu.
Maybe it can come together from that, but it can't hold together. You know, this is why, I don't know if you've ever studied the Chinese concept of the mandate of heaven.
Uh-uh.
Take a look at it. There has to be, if you look at great reserve currencies, there has to be something there that people feel is reliable and useful with which to trade. And right now, everybody's a criminal.
But yeah, right. It's the criminocracy, yes.
Right.
But I think, you know, back to your point about can it hold together, that's not, maybe it can, maybe it can't. That's not the question. The question is, do the criminals in charge think they can hold it together? And I think the answer to that is yes.
Oh, yeah, I think they do. But I also think they've been breathing their own bell jar air.
For sure. They've been doing that. They may be wrong, but that doesn't mean they don't think it.
Right. No, I think they can. I think they can hold it together with force, and I don't believe it.
Right. I don't either. Anyway, right. Let's just move on to our one of our favorite guys, the inevitable. You ready?
Oh, God.
The inevitable. Mark, there he is. Yay.
He's repositioned to look like Bobby Kennedy. See the hair? The change in the hair?
Yeah. They've totally they're massaging his persona. Former Bank of England governor throws support behind CBDCs. That's a shock. Can't believe this is going on. In a speech to the Bank for International Settlements, you know, Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of England, the Bank of Canada, argued that further integration of stablecoins into the global economy would give big tech too much power in the economy and would be difficult to unwind. That's a statement to pay attention to, right?
Yeah.
Because just given the source.
Right. There is no doubt the finance guys, you know, the finance guys have always considered they rule the roost and the tech guys have to do whatever they want.
Right.
But now the tech guys are making them nervous.
Yeah.
And there is a real tension there, and it's not unrelated to the fact that DOD just booted out they're going to rebid the Jedi contract.
Right.
Well, they failed to let the Jedi contract, and that's a big one.
Yeah.
Right.
But that's to me the importance of the Carney statement is A, it's Carney. He's one of the chosen ones, and B, he gave that speech to the BIS.
Right.
If you're a tech guy, you're going to find out you're not top dog. Okay.
Now, what I think is really important is what you and I discussed yesterday. You know, you are of the opinion that the Fed has to go for authorizing legislation to do a CBDC, which I think is good news. Very good news. Because they got to write it down and make it plain.
Yeah.
And, not to say that things can't get slipped through at the last minute, they always do, but I just think that's going to be a process that brings all the Midianites into attacking each other's jugular. That's going to be a very interesting thing, and they're not going to be able to sneak down to Georgia, you know, overnight on a train.
No.
Right.
No. Yeah, it's a big deal, but I think they have to dot that I and cross those T's, because the Fed absolutely is not going to leave itself open to any legal challenge that they have exceeded their mandate under the Federal Reserve Act,
right?
Which they would be doing if they didn't get that authorizing legislation,
right?
You know, and they're not gonna. I mean, would the lawsuit succeed? Probably it wouldn't, but that's not the point. The point is, if that lawsuit survives a dismissal stage, you get into discovery, where you know the plaintiff in a lawsuit discovers the internal documents of the defendant and vice versa. But the Fed is worried about, hey, we don't want to get to discovery. That's why they're going to have to get that authorizing legislation. No doubt about that.
I think you're right. I think you're right. I think there's a very high chance of that.
Yeah. And Powell has said, you know, remember he was asked, is it legal? Remember he in that one forum, somebody, I think it was Gillian Tett, says, well, CBDCs, are they legal? And Powell's like, well, that's a good question. Well, we get authorized. do you remember that?
Who was the other guy there? Because he rolled his eyes. The ECB guy rolled his eyes when Powell said that.
Yeah, a guy named Jan Vemmers or something.
Yeah, yeah.
He was laughing, and so was Karstens. There was some inside joke going on in that clip, because they had definitely bum rushed Powell, who was on his toes and didn't handle it his best, but he handled it, and they were happy, but. Remember, Powell said authorizing legislation is coming.
Right.
Anyway, next story in CBDC. Here we go. U.S. CBDC prototype ready soon, but will anyone use it?
Coming this month.
Yeah, very interesting. Coming this month.
Right.
Ben, this story is from July. It's coming this month. This story is from March 24th. So I guess they missed that deadline, huh?
Right. Oh, no, here, I, the never, latest you're announcement right, you're is right. July. The latest announcement is this month.
It says that. First prototype would be ready in July. And China is leading the race. So, yeah, it's a good time to circle back to the story because at the beginning of July, they're saying CBDC is going to roll out in July. We'll see. I don't necessarily believe that. But there you have it. You know? I mean, I don't see it happen in July, do you?
There's nothing like throwing the entire planet into a global invention room.
Yeah, right. Right, exactly. Another story on China and CBDC. China's digital currency is about to disrupt money. The inevitable disruption.
Now remember, they basically banned Bitcoin and they just went after, now they're going after service providers. They're saying not only can you not trade Bitcoin, but now you can't make software for it.
Yeah, right. This article points out an interesting thing. What is the significance of China's being the first world's major economy to launch a digital currency? I don't know if I agree with this, but it's an interesting notion. It largely eliminates the ability of the United States to impose sanctions and blockades based on SWIFT transfer system.
I just don't see that because...
I don't either.
You know, that implies that it's going to have massive volume outside of China. I just don't see that.
Yeah. And this could be, you know, you see these swords of Damocles being held up, like, well, you better get your CBDC, because if you don't, if China's first, you know, you're going to lose your ability to impose sanctions.
Well, you know, China, you know, there's a lot of effort to make China the new boogeyman.
Yeah, and, for sure.
You know, I get 10 China is the boogeyman, here it comes emails a day.
Yeah, I'll bet. Right. Yeah. Okay, next, I know. China's a useful tool for a lot of people. Let's right. just say that.
Right.
Anyway. Next story on CBDC. This is the cloud story, the Jedi Cloud.
Yep.
This is a big one.
That when I saw that, I laughed for 5 minutes straight. It was funny because, you know, I have a lot of experience with government contracting.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think what happened was they just had too much time and effort in the courts with Oracle and with Amazon over the Microsoft win. And so they're just going to rebid the contract. Now, I don't think they've killed the Jedi Cloud deal. I just think they're going to start rebidding the contract all over again.
No, they say in this story, I thought I had it highlighted. I guess I don't. That they're going to split it. They're going to split the cloud between Amazon and Microsoft.
Well, but don't they have to rebid it to do that, or are they just...
That's not
I'm
what
assuming they got to go through a new bid process.
Well, here, let's just look at this paragraph. Make sure it's up high enough for everybody to see it. The Pentagon said in a press release that it still needs enterprise-scale cloud capability and announced a new multi-vendor contract known as the Joint Warfighter Cloud Capability. So what does that mean, that the Pentagon announced a new multi-vendor contract? It sounds like
so they're just going to use a different contracting vehicle for legal reasons, is my guess.
Yeah.
But I agree that the way they solve this is going to try and have Amazon in for half and Microsoft in for half. And the thing to understand about this, John, is basically I view Amazon as a company that's owned and operated by the CIA.
Right. So, to be sure. Yeah.
Right. And so this is a squabble. This is a turf war between the intelligence agencies and the DOD as to who controls what pieces of the data beast.
Right. Right.
That's what it's about. And I see Microsoft as basically owned and operated by NSA. So you're having a little bit of squabble as to whether the DOD, the Pentagon cloud away from the Navy, because remember, Navy has Leidos, which is the old Lockheed IT. So whether NSA or the CIA is going to own and operate the DOD data beast.
Huh.
So to me, this is just a data beast turf war. And yep. And the question is, how are you going to slice up the pie?
That's what it looks like to me. Remember, we were on Money Markets months ago when Amazon right. first launched this lawsuit. And it was like, what's going on here? Well, it looks like a turf war.
It's a turf war. So, but here's why this is an important turf war. If you're globalizing the military and you're globalizing the, you know, the dollar system, and you're globalizing the taxation, a lot of your reengineering to get whatever, wherever they're going, a lot of your reengineering requires cutting out the civil service and reengineering all the payments through these cloud operations through private companies. Mm-hmm. So it's these companies plus the defense contractors and the banks. And basically you're taking complete control of the U.S. government carcass, federal carcass, through the digital systems controlled and operated by the banks and the tech companies and the defense contractors.
Right.
Once you have it completely in, that's when you can really take gigantic shifts. And by the JEDI contract being delayed, it delays the big piece of the reengineering. So you know how I'm always saying, you know, they want the smart grid everywhere, everything, you know, you get the smart grid plus, you know, a complete digitization by private parties of the federal carcass. And that's when you can really radically reengineer.
Huh.
Very, I mean, imagine paying your taxes and getting your government checks through Amazon.
That's horrifying.
Right. You completely cut out this the federal, state, and local civil service, and you can reengineer everything. It's amazing how much reengineering can be done. And if you look at the reports I'm getting from the civil service in Washington, they are being steadily left at home and cut out, and their access to data or the building is being cut out. And it's clearly part of this, you know, it is a coup d'etat.
Yes.
Right.
It's executing the plan. The coup d'etat, to me, it took place. That's a done deal.
Right. It started, the coup d'etat, to me, started in 1990. Well, it started in 81 when Bush arranged for private corporations to do classified functions. But then it grew and grew and grew and grew. And then in the 90s with the financial coup, that's when the banks and the private contractors and the tech companies started taking complete control. And I really believe that the thing that really drove that train was a backdoor in Windows 95. I'm told there was a special edition just for government, but you put a backdoor in Windows 95 and all the software, and then you get everybody, you know, with a control file with the child porn networks, and you're off to the races. And that's how they stole $21 trillion. I'm grossly oversimplifying, but...
You know, we could do 10 episodes on... The... No, I'm not kidding. I mean, right. I think about it. You could do 10 episodes on the coup d'etat. And if I were making a documentary, the first date of my presentation on the coup in America would be July 5th, 1776. That's right. When it started.
Right.
You know, I mean, this has been in the works for a while. Yes. You know, anyway. Okay, on to happier topics.
Yes.
Pushback. Yes. Speaking of July 4th.
You know, the pushback has been incredible.
This is great.
It's fabulous. Now,
the first story doesn't really match up, but we're going to slot it there anyway. And this is, you know, you're starting to see the Supreme Court, you know, get a little more reasonable with, you know, voter integrity, free speech, and religious liberty. You know, this is kind of funny, you know, coming from a conservative publication saying, hey, they've Supreme Court's defending religious liberty and free speech. But they've done a bunch of things, and a lot of them have been unanimous decisions. You know, you see here consensus oriented term. But then let's just roll down. The last two decisions of this term in the Supreme Court were bound to be controversial. One involved voting integrity measures implemented in Arizona, right? So they're going to let that roll forward. Legal experts seem to agree that the ruling dooms the Biden Garland DOJ's politically motivated lawsuit against Georgia's new election laws. So there's a lot to me.
That's good news.
That's good news. There's a lot of been a lot of pushback about this election.
Right.
And that's not good. If you have people, you know, on a widespread basis doubting the integrity of the election, that's not good for business, is it?
Right.
You know, right. But go back to this story and scroll down a little more. There's another that for the final ruling handed down today. It's a major win for free speech and privacy. And this concerns donor lists for advocacy organizations has been weaponized by mobs. And you see the Times take on it. The Supreme Court rejected California's requirement that charities report identities of major donors, siding with conservative groups who said that disclosures could lead to harassment. You know?
Well, you know, although on the IRS forms that are required to be public by charities, they've got to, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's got to be disclosed.
Right.
So there's still federal disclosure requirements.
To be sure.
Right.
But you're not going to go out. I mean, again, this is Supreme Court. I don't care what anybody says. It's a political animal. It's a product of politics. It's
right.
The Article 3 is the product of a political process. You know, they're not issuing these decisions in a vacuum. They're well aware of you know, people feeling disenfranchised and people feeling like, you know, you're out to get us.
So one thing I'll say about politics in this world, you got to fight for every inch,
yeah.
no matter how bad it is. And if you look at what Trump did for the Supreme Court versus what Hillary Clinton would have done, it's a reminder that things could be a lot worse.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. All right, moving on. This is pushback from physicians, and this is serious.
Fabulous.
This is a lawsuit, and I don't, you know, have it zoomed in really enough, but you could see there the complaint, and you can't see it from maybe if I could drag.
Yeah,
it
I can.
In.
I can see it. So
yeah, what I'm saying is you can't really see.
Yeah, American Frontline Doctors out of Los Angeles. This is
you
Simone
see that?
Gold. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
This is Simone Gold and her group have filed a complaint to halt the COVID vaccine in children.
Right.
And they have used an expert opinion from the Doctors for COVID Ethics here in Europe. That is one of the most impressive things I've ever seen, John, which was filed. Renata Holstein filed it in Europe last week, and we just got clearance, and we'll put it up on the website, a link to her filing here in Europe. And so now we have the creme de la creme of European and American doctors going into court and going into court with expert opinions, which are as astonishingly professional and brilliant as anything I've ever seen. We put a copy of the expert witness document that Renata filed. It's going to be revised for the American Frontline Doctors. It's up on the website now at Saleri.com. And it just links over to the Doctors for COVID Ethics. And if you know anybody who is even thinking of taking one of these injections, you just want to force them to sit down and read it. And it's absolutely, you know, these are people who know, you know, I can't speak enough. I can't say enough good about them, but they are, you know, they are the finest minds, I think, in North America and Europe on this subject with, you know, they're both scientists and MDs.
Right.
And a lot of science has come out since these injections started in December. They've learned a lot and they keep turning it around and just publishing it again and again.
And so, this lawsuit, you know, speaking of the theme, you know, pushback heroes of the long, hot summer. You know, the physician's lawsuit that I've was trying to move the caption in the position so you can see that's in the federal district court. It's in the Northern District of Alabama. So So they thought about where to file this.
That's a friendly jurisdiction.
Well, okay. So it's Article 3 judges who, again, they're supposedly independent. They know where they live. Yeah.
Right.
So that jurisdiction is not, that's not some accident. You know, the physicians thought about where to file that lawsuit. So anyway, that's a deal. This whole thing is just crazy, but at least physicians are saying, you know, you can't be vaccinating kids, you know?
Well, here's the thing. The reason I'm so bullish on this expert thing, the first time I read it, John, it's so excellent.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to it. It's the next
thing.
Yeah. And, so let's take a look at it and we can get into it. But here you go. Expert evidence regarding, how does that word? It's Pfizer.
Comirnaty.
Okay. COVID mRNA vaccine for children.
Right.
Okay. And so this statement, what you're going to read there is the expert statement. That's what follows the blue highlighted there. Was submitted by Italian lawyer, Renata Holzein,
Holzein.
Holzin, okay, in conjunction with the lawsuit that challenges the EU's authorization of the use of Pfizer's mRNA vaccine on children of 12 years and older. So if they win on 12 years and older, they're going to win on, 11 and younger.
Right.
The arguments made here specifically reference the Pfizer vaccine, but they apply to all the vaccines. And then you get into this, you can download the statement and see. And it's, I've read it, you looked at it. It's an extensive piece of work.
Right.
That lays out all the dangers. Now, the one question I have, though, is, having done a bunch of expert reports myself and litigated them, is since these things are published on the internet, presumably in the U.S., they have not used confidential information from internal Pfizer files or J&J files, right? Because when you file an expert report, the defendant's not going to let you publish its...
Right.
That you enter a protective order. It's an agreement by the parties to the lawsuit saying, I agree that I get your inside information, your internal documents. It's confidential. I'm not going to publish it to the whole wide world. So my question is this expert report really the best foot forward for the lawsuit, since presumably they don't have inside information from
Pfizer? So the challenge you have, if you are these scientists and doctors, is we don't really know what's in this stuff. In other words, if you look at our disclosure of what's in the injection, we know what's happening to people and what we're seeing in the chemistry of their bodies as a result of the injection. But I don't know of anybody who has a complete, there are a few people who say they've gotten a hold of vials, but I don't know of anybody who's got a complete disclosure that is reliable on what is really in this stuff.
Right. So that's the question. Is there could be two ways you would know what's inside those vials. One would be Pfizer tells you, J&J tells you, Moderna tells you, here's a list of ingredients.
But do you believe them? I mean, these are organizations that have a track record of not telling the truth.
In an interrogatory response, I would probably be very deeply skeptical.
Right.
In internal documents, I'd be more inclined to believe it.
Right.
Especially if internal documents waved in front of witnesses and I question the witnesses, I'm going to know pretty quickly whether that document's real or not. So do the physicians know what's in it? One way would be they, internal documents. The other way would be you test it. You reverse engineer it, basically.
Right.
And so I don't know where they are.
There has been some of that, but I would say it's not enough to really rely on.
Right.
What they do know is what the companies have made public, or through the FDA or any of the authorizing agencies. They do know what they've gotten on FOIA. So one of the things that is affecting the expert witness is the FOIA from the Japanese agency. But they also know what doctors and scientists around the world are publishing about what they're learning from people who've been injected.
Right.
And so, so it's interesting because every week you see they learn more because you have people all over the world, getting pieces and sending it in and sharing it. It's like a jigsaw puzzle piece and they just keep adding pieces. And so what has come out from treating people who have vaccine injury is an awful lot of information about what's chemically happening, what's physically happening to people's bodies.
Right. The truth is going to come out.
Right.
Whether it comes out through testing or that you've injected a billion people or a lawsuit, it's coming out.
Right.
We're going to find out. I mean, you've seen reports of like graphene in vials, metal in the injections.
Well, what I keep being told by various doctors is they're getting so many reports about this magnetism phenomena.
Yeah.
That something is absolutely happening. We don't understand it, but it's absolutely happening.
Yeah.
And of course, the big question is how does it relate to 5G and EMF?
Right. And how does it advance the monetary interest of the powers that be?
Right.
Anyway, so continuing on, pushback. Now, this is a good one. I love this one because I'm in North Carolina right now. This is Bank of America.
Oh, this is fabulous.
So Bank of America, and that guy there you see in that frame of the video is Brian Moynihan, the CEO. He's the successor to Ken Lewis, another, just a dubious character. So they're going to come back to the office, right? They've got to, everybody's going to come back to work. And we learn in this story, I've got it highlighted here. So Moynihan says, well, about 60,000 people in the U.S. have told us their status. He said, and that's about 70,000 employees outside the U.S. So it's 60,000 in the U.S. and 70,000 outside the U.S. And we've got 212,000 employees, you know, worldwide. So, you know, you're looking at a little bit over half of people who've gotten rejected, right?
Right.
And that's it. Meaning that most of that company, and I think the figure I saw in another story was 38% of Bank of America weren't fully vaccinated. And but the other story was behind a paywall, so I couldn't put it up. But so 38% of Bank of America's employees, and then you know, Ben,
was
you
it
know,
38% who wouldn't, or was it? I thought it was 60% who refused to get the vaccination.
No,
so it was 40% who were vaccinated.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at this, if you take the CNBC quote at face value, about 60,000 people in the U.S. have told us that. Well, no, you can't read that. He's just saying they told us their status. That's it. That's
right.
Not necessarily
it doesn't. You don't know whether they're vaccinated or not. So
right.
So one, they're not willing to share the data.
Right.
In other words, they're saying, you know, what I've done is private. It's none of your business.
Yeah.
And number two, you know, clearly there's some significant amount of people who refuse to share their status or get vaccinated.
You know.
And he had to walk it back.
I remember what it was now. There was a tweet that you and I both saw it.
Right.
And it said, you know, only 38%. were vaccinated and the rest of the people were taking a pass. And then we went back to, you know, yesterday we were going through the stories. I was like, well, I can't, you know, the link to that tweet is, you know, it's a dead link now. You know, so I started searching around. That's what I come up with. So, you know, it's vanished down the memory hole. That's a, let this be a lesson to you, laddie. You got to take screenshots, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I just did an interview on Greg Hunter and he had two subscribers or two members of his audience who would use the forms we put up, one with schools and one with employers, and they got them to walk back the mandate.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great.
So I'm telling you, you don't know what's going to happen until you walk in there one person to one person and start holding them accountable step by step by step by step for the facts and all the financial issues. And, you know, we have so much more leverage than we know, and that's, you know, those forms aren't perfect and they need to be redone for a full authorization world, you know, but take them, adapt them locally, adapt them to your jurisdiction, use them because people can't just make you kill yourself for free.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So pushback. It's working. It's very much working. That's great to hear about Greg Hunter. Great to hear about Bank of America employees pushing back. I mean, because you know they're getting the pressure. But the next story, this is a video from Australia, the pushback.
Oh.
I mean, Australia has just devolved into outright fascism.
Right.
They're getting pushed back there in political circles. So I want to roll this clip. I know you've seen it.
This is great. This is great.
Yeah, let's just take a look at this.
It has contributed to a significant increase in adverse event reports. We currently have about 11,000 adverse event reports for the two COVID vaccines in front of the TGA. Our job is to look for the needle in that haystack. Ultimately, it's a decision of government, and we sort of really can't comment further than that.
Okay, if they say compensation is available through the courts and they're given indemnity insurance to vaccine suppliers?
Correct.
People can only get paid compensation if they go through the courts. So obviously the government would know this, and if it doesn't, it needs to get a handle on the situation. Most people cannot afford to go through the courts. They're delusional. That's the first thing. And by the way, they're chocked. So... And even if they win, which would be an uphill, that would be an uphill battle for them. Do you think that the lack of compensation system has to do with why people are so hesitant to go out and get a jab? But trust me, Mr. Murphy, as a senator, I'm saying you're not compensated. I'm making that very clear to people out there. I'm not going to sit there and lie to them. So if they, something goes wrong, I'm telling them how hard it is, because that is my job as a senator. So how do you think the government's going to go us by us telling the truth out there to the people that, you know what, if something goes wrong, you're stuffed because your government isn't going to look after you and you're not getting compensation?
I would hope you wouldn't say to the public that if something goes wrong, you're stuffed, Senator. That would not be good
for... Well, that's the truth, Mr. Murphy. It takes years to get through a court system. If you do get sick from this stuff, you will get sick. I'm not going to sit here and pretend that's not happening or that won't happen. Because I'm
okay.
not telling the truth, Mr. Murphy.
Thanks. Okay, Senator Lambie, if we let Professor Murphy respond.
So, look, I don't think I can add anything more to it, Senator. That's been a decision of government to not go down that.
Significant, which is obviously why they're in the 1B, quite significant issues. So, does that apply to anybody in 1B?
There's no evidence that any underlying medical conditions predispose to this reaction, with rare reaction. It appears out of the blue, whether you have an underlying medical condition or not. And there's no...
Okay, so there's a lot going on there, obviously.
Right.
But the key piece is this: the woman senator just blasting the guy, the health official.
Yeah, that's the senator who understands how the money works on vaccine injury.
Saying, you know, these people aren't going to be compensated. Let's not pretend they're not going to be compensated. And he said, well, you can go through the courts. She says, it takes forever to get through the courts. Let's not play around with that.
Right.
And he's just like, well, you know, this is, you know, and the health official, you see the reversal of what we saw in Canada. The health official say, well, it's a government decision. We can't undo it. You know, so it's like, well, you know, we can't do anything about it. That's how the game, you know, what a bunch of cowards. You know, it's disgusting.
You know something? One of the greatest things that ever happened to me is I worked at HUD, because one of the things I learned was, you know, it's like I walked out of there with an encyclopedia of lying.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Uh-huh.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I had to litigate for 10 years.
Send people around in the 26-step process.
Until you see it firsthand, it's really hard to believe the scale of the lying and the culture of the lying.
Right.
Like it's like normal expected behavior in some circles. I mean, I had to litigate 10 years against a firm that was just professional liars. They would just lie. And that kind of paved my way, even though I was sort of asleep at the time, that paved my way for me to understand that you could lie about something like a $21 trillion crisis or a pandemic. I get it.
Right.
I've seen it.
Right. You know. I know.
Anyway, last pushback story, and I apologize, I can't really tell you why this. I have this as a pushback story, but I do. Anyway, this is, you can explain this one.
Okay, I had to cover this.
Yeah.
So I have dealt with, over the last 20 years, phenomenal levels of literally criminal bill games, bill padding, bill manipulation by the telecoms.
Yeah.
And it's a plan. It's a business model to pad and manipulate bills. And I've had incredible experience, particularly with AT&T. And so now we're seeing real, finally, sort of systemic pushback against it. But I wanted to just have this story in here, John, because I think it's so important to remind everybody, please, you know, please keep records of your telecom bills and please research and investigate them carefully, because you may find thousands of dollars being drained out of the back door, particularly if you're a small business. It's outrageous.
And I'll confess, I don't really, the piece that I had up there isn't particularly well written.
Right.
So it's sort of hard for me to see what's going on. But evidently, you know, I'm kind of reading between the lines. There was a lawsuit at some point by this group called, I can't scroll down far enough, called, I'm gonna kind of do a brute force drag up here. Here we go. The group, this is the website of a group called the irregulators.org. But apparently there was a case in 2020, Irregulators versus FCC delivered a decision that freed the states. And there was some sort of disclosure that came out of this that detailed all the padding that you're talking about.
Right.
And they just sort of outlined it in this story. But I,
it's remarkable. The amount of money that's been drained from the U.S. economy by unnecessary padding by telecoms.
It's a big,
particularly because so much of the infrastructure is paid for by the taxpayer.
Yeah.
So the taxpayer builds the infrastructure and then they harvest it. It's one of the more appalling industries.
Yeah. Okay. So let's, I want to cut over. We've got to circle back to, what is it? Space, military, and global turf wars.
Right.
Because we're going to get into the Didi story.
Right.
Right. And that's a big one.
Yeah, there was an update on that today. So we have a lot to talk about on Didi.
Yeah.
This is astonishing, John. As somebody who is a underwriter leading deals, you know, leading the equivalent of IPOs.
Yeah.
You know, this one to me is absolutely amazing.
Well, let's first look at this story. U.S. and Japan conduct war games. Are you looking at that?
Right.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, the Taiwan situation, Hong Kong and Taiwan is scary because if, in fact, the U.S., Taiwan, if China tries to take over Taiwan, you are looking at, you know, a near monopoly situation on microchips.
Yeah.
Because Taiwan is such a big player in that technology.
I'm going to try to make this a little bit bigger on the fly here so we can zoom in a little bit better. I think there's one story in a series that I had to sort of shrink the screen down to fit it, but now we got it all. So this is sort of the backstory on what's going on there. U.S. and Japan have become alarmed as China has flown more fighter jets and bombers into Taiwan's air defense identification zone, including a record 28 fighters on June 15th.
Right. This is serious.
This is serious business.
This is serious.
That's a very loud growl.
Right.
China insists that it wants to unify Taiwan with the mainland, and while it says it wants peaceful unification, it has not ruled out the use of force to seize control of Taiwan. Wow.
The day they think they can do it, they're going to do it.
Yeah, right. I think that's probably a good read of that.
Right.
Anyway, so that's sort of one thing going on. And then against the backdrop of that, we have this other story. Let me flip over to here. Are you looking at that? Oh, I got a little, that's a little high.
So Didi is a, basically a ride hailing giant. It went public, led by senior managers, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and JP Morgan. Goldman Sachs ran the books. And what was interesting, I told you when I looked at the prospectus yesterday, is the first prospectus for an IPO where I never saw a name for the Underwriters Council. Because I was trying to figure out who was responsible for the disclosure.
Right.
So this thing goes public at $60 billion value. And you got the chart?
Yeah.
So
let's go.
The Chinese regulators slap it with an action after it goes public.
There's
and
the chart.
It is already down 10%. Now that's $6 billion. On a $60 billion market cap, that's $6 billion.
Right.
So you go public, and a few days later, the regulators hit you with an action, and you're down 10%, down $6 billion.
Right.
Now, here's the interesting thing. It comes out today that the regulators had warned Didi that they were going to do this, or they might do this. Now, I'm assuming they didn't properly disclose that. And if that's the case, Goldman and the Underwriters Council are liable for that $6 billion.
Right. Well, we shall see, right?
Right.
But let's go back to the chart. Let's just look at the chart. And this is the chart for 2021.
Right. So what you're looking at is the red line is the is one of the major bond ETFs.
Uh-huh.
So it's down 1% for this period. This is year to date.
Yep.
And then the blue line is FXI, which is the large China ETF. So it's large cap China ETF. And then the top line is the S&P. So for year to date, the S&P is up 15%.
Right.
So as you can see, Didi comes out, and as Didi flies up, FXI is going down. Interesting.
Right. So Didi is the green on the right, the green spike on the right.
So it spikes, you know, they come out at, they price the IPO at 14, it flies up to 16, about 16 and 80 cents, I think was the high, 16.84. And then the regulators slap it, and right. sure enough, it takes a nosedive. It's down 10% from the, well, it's down more than 10% from the high, but it's down 10% from where it came out. And this is an extraordinary action, John.
Well, let's look at the 5-day, because there you go.
Right.
That zooms
that
in.
That says it all.
There you go. So it's down 11%.
Right.
Right. Okay. And now let's flip back over to the story, right, on what got this whole ball rolling. And there you go. China's cybersecurity regulator has ordered Didi be taken off domestic app stores just days after the ride-hailing giant raised $4.4 billion in the biggest Chinese listing in the U.S. since Alibaba in 2014. And you see that the effect of that in the graph there.
Right.
Right. Right. That's what did that. Slapped it right back down. Very aggressive on China's part.
So I was shocked. I was assumed that Goldman and Morgan Stanley wouldn't take it public if they knew this was coming.
Right.
And, you know, and I was amazed that the Chinese regulators would have slapped it this way after it had IPO'd. And to me, it's all part of the tearing. You know, you're watching a real tearing between China and the Anglo-American alliance in terms of financial markets. So there is a real war going on. Now that it turns out that the regulators had warned Didi before the offering, I'm like, Goldman Sachs, what are you thinking of?
Right.
What were you doing?
Right.
I don't. This one to me is baffling, and it's going to be very interesting over the next month or two to see what the big investors who were in the IPO do.
Right. Fair to say China's hot. I mean, 28 fighter jets on one day, right?
Right.
They're not ruling out taking over Taiwan and then that aggressive action on Didi.
Well, they knew this was going to cost a group of the investors $6 billion. They knew that.
Of course.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's a story worth keeping your eye on. Anyway. The last story in kind of global turf wars here, Facebook, Twitter, Google threatened to quit Hong Kong over proposed data laws. I'm not really sure what's going on here, but let me scroll up. So the issue is there's some proposed legislation in Hong Kong, and the companies are saying, this group of internet companies, if authorities proceed with planned changes to data protection laws, that could make them liable for malicious sharing of individuals' information online. That's what they're worried about.
Right.
Is they're worried about if you get doxxed, you know, with this legislation.
That they're liable.
That they're going to be liable. And doxxing refers to the practice of putting people's personal information online so they can be harassed by others. And the tech companies are like, we don't want to be liable for that, you know?
Right.
And so they're talking about punishment. So what punishment are the tech companies worried about? And here you go. I don't think they're worried about the money here, but the proposals call for punishment of up to $1 million Hong Kong dollars, the equivalent of about $129,000, and up to 5 years imprisonment. That's what they're worried about, right?
Right.
Yeah. So that's an interesting story.
It is an interesting story, and I can't tell whether what's happening in Hong Kong is, if you've ever seen them, there's a documentary that's very hard to find. We've had on Let's Go to the Movies called The Cleaners, and it's about the companies in the Philippines that clean inappropriate content off of, you know, the censor.
Yeah.
If you watch this documentary and you realize how much really horrible, violent, pornographic, disgusting. I mean, if you look at what they're cleaning off, it's pretty shocking.
Wow.
You know, if you think that it's just the guys at the top who are corrupt, where do you see the corruption at the bottom? It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
And and if you look at what a hard job it is, you know, how many they have to look at, like 25,000 views a day in their job, you know, and they're just clicking really fast. If you look at how hard it is to catch everything with AI and software and how hard the cleaning function is, I can see legitimately why a company like Google would not want to be responsible for perfection if it involved imprisonment of staff.
I get it.
Right. I totally get that. At
yeah.
the same time, what I have to say is all these companies have been so such pigs and liars on the privacy issue.
Yeah.
That
right.
it doesn't surprise me to see them running into all sorts of problems all over the place because they have destroyed trust.
Yeah.
And now there's nothing, there's no juice to work with politically because they're criminals.
Yeah. The chickens have come home. Chickens have come home to roost.
The chickens have come home to roost and you can't work with these people. And it's what Lavrov right. said. He
yes.
said the Americans are not agreement capable. Well, I got news from the tech companies are not agreement capable.
Right. And you've been running amok for decades and now you've painted yourself into a corner and you don't like
right.
it.
Right. Right.
Hmm. Hard to be sympathetic.
I have
must
no
say.
Sympathy for those guys.
Yeah. Hard to be sympathetic.
Right. Right.
Anyway, so pushback is you know, pushback and the paint.
Well,
here's
the thing
back.
To remember. If you can only do this week, take a look at what American frontline doctors did. Take a look at what the expert witnesses did. Take a look at what Renata Holstein has done in Italy and Europe and you know, just realize that some of the most brilliant, best minds in the world are out there fighting every day and taking unbelievable risks, risking their life, you know, without concern. Because their attitude is, you know, whatever yeah. you guys are a part of, I have no interest in living in that civilization. I can't tell you how many brilliant, professional, capable people have said to me, you know, something, we need to start a new civilization.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's astonishing. I mean, it's not really... They're taking risks. They're going to the mat in
right.
a lot of cases, knowing the consequences are going to be really rough on them.
Well, but what they realize is, you know, it's an easy decision once you understand how bad the other thing is.
Right. Right.
You
they
know,
get it. There's a freedom to it.
Right. Do you really want to live in a world with no facts and no science? I don't.
No. Right. Right. Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
do you want your neurosurgery performed by a central banker? I don't think so.
Right. That's that cartoon. The same
right.
people who own the banks own the hospitals.
Right.
You
right.
want them operating on you? I don't want them sticking a needle in me. It's a hard pass there.
Okay, John. Well, anything else before we close?
I think we've covered it all.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
well,
it.
Stay cool. And when are you going to be back in your hometown? When are you going to be out of the CIA safe house?
I think we have one more episode in the safe house, and
okay.
then I'll be back out, back home.
Okay,
anyway.
Great. Okay,
all
well,
right.
Be well. Stay cool. Have a great day. Thanks, John.
All right, Catherine. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.